Good evening. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio and our Shabbat program this evening. My pleasure to be with you. We have James and Larry. How are you, fellas?
Doing good.
Oh, I'm doing great. In the middle of a debate here.
Uh-oh, what happened there, Larry?
Oh, well, we got a guy that says I'm straining gnats because I tell him words like holy and names like Yeshua are nonsense.
Ah, yes. I've been called a gnat
strainer.
Straining
gnats.
Yes.
Straining gnats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
give him Yahweh's words.
If you're serious about Yahweh's testimony, and by the way, he says that he is represented by his words. So if representing his word accurately so as to represent him accurately is all about gnat catching, then let's all become gnat catchers. No?
Okay.
Yeah, happy to be accused. That's one of the things I never did understand about people who think that if you tell them that Yahweh is represented by his words, that is his presence in our world. And if you tell somebody that, most people will say, okay, I get it. He's represented by his testimony, his words. And then you say, so is it appropriate to mistranslate and change those words so as to misrepresent him and to change his nature? The problem most people would say, no. Then why do you call him holy? Why do you call him Jesus? Why do you call him Lord? Why do you fear him?
Why do you call him Yeshua?
Yeah, why do you do that? It is a tragedy that folks don't understand the importance of words when it comes to understanding who Yahweh is. We do have, James, I know you know Yoel, and Larry, I think you were with us back in the days that Yoel and I did this program together.
I do recall. Yes, I do.
We have a Yoel also with us this evening.
Hi there, guys.
Yeah, there we go.
How's it going?
Good. He's out with his family visiting. If you hear the sounds of splashing and boys and girls giggling in the pool, that's right outside of my studio here, and they're having fun. They've already worn my dog out, who's now taking a nap.
My granddaughter just wore me out, so
okay.
I
well, yeah, that
out.
Happens, doesn't it?
It doesn't.
Last week, I don't think I've ever had a week where I got more correspondence from a presentation than last week. And last week was a really uncomfortable topic for me to talk about because, while I don't want to infer that it's okay in any way to ignore what God says, I always want to stress that understanding what he's telling us and why he's telling us is more important than to physically do what he says without thinking about it. And most of the time when you head down that path, people have a tendency to go into extreme camps. And so it becomes a really vulnerable and uncomfortable topic. And yet, 100% of the feedback I got from last week was, wow, that was a great learning experience. It's so typical, yeah. Wonderful insights. The deeper you look, the clearer the picture becomes. Great use of an hour and a half. I should tell you one other thing that was interesting, and I just did not have the time to process it all this week, so I'll share it with you next week. But Mike Bellotti did an analysis of the two beasties that were impossible to ascertain. You know, the two that, you know, that there is no such animal in the world. And he, based upon a study of the etymology of the words, came to think that the most likely candidates for the two was the first being a giraffe and the second being a hippopotamus. And he said, okay, if there were no giraffes, there were no hippopotamuses in Israel. Probably not a lot of wild boars, if any, in Israel either. And in fact, just in Israel, not a lot of camels, if any camels, in Israel. So the things that God said on the list, don't eat, really didn't exist in Israel because that wasn't the point. The point was to tell us that we should avoid eating things that, unless we, like the animal, is really going to be thorough in our digestion of the nutrition. You know, that the cud aspect of getting absolute the maximum amount of intake and nourishment out of the words, which Laurie goes right back to the gnat straining accusation. The more you of Yah's testimony that you devour, the more completely you devour it, the healthier you're going to be. And that was why all of the animals on Yah's list were processed their the grasses that they were consuming, not once but twice, thoroughly, digesting it completely. And the second was he wanted us to consume that which has a separated foot. And the reason for the separated foot is that every aspect of the Torah, particularly the covenant, has us walking away from countries, from our personal religious experience or societal experience, and to God. And everything that's important to God is set apart. It's separated. And so he said, you know, I want you to be nourished by that which has a separated foot, so that you're walking toward me and away from humankind. And then we went through and we said, okay, the camel is interesting because the camel represents Islam. All of the Quran and Hadith is fixated on camel offerings to appease Allah. And then we looked at the wild hog, and the wild hog was the basis of the Babylonian religion. It was the wild hog that gored Tammuz to create the 40 days of weeping for Tammuz, to create the first Easter, to require the myth that the sun impregnated Mother Earth, and 9 months later the son of the sun was born. All that was based upon the legend of the wild boar. So you've got now the Babylonian religion, in addition to the most vicious religion to Yahweh's people, Islam. Now, if Mike is right, and the third one is the giraffe, you might say, so what the idiocy is a giraffe? Well, the giraffe was the single favorite animal of the pharaohs. And the pharaohs used to parade giraffes. They didn't eat them. They paraded giraffes down the boulevards of their cities and in their festivals because it was such a large, elegant, unusual animal that they imported from the, you know, from way further south than Egypt, that it was a sign of religious and political status in Egypt. So now you've got the third religion nailed. And the last one was his study came up with hippopotamus. And his research is really fascinating. And I'll go into more detail on another program when I have a quieter week and I can really devour what he had to send me. But the hippopotamus. And you might say, okay, now what in the world is hippopotamus? Well, throughout all of the animist religions of Africa, throughout all of the animist religions of Asia, the hippopotamus was the principal sign of deity, and they became a fertility symbol. And they were worshipped as gods throughout all of those regions as a fertility symbol. And so the hippopotamus represents what is even today the most prevalent religion in Africa is animism. The you know, that nature represents God. So there was even more to it than what we talked about. And we're going to jump in here on the 99th statement and the 119th verse. And this is the Mem section of the 119th Psalm. Mem is symbolized water. Water, source of life, source of cleansing, and source of renewal is communicated by Mem. But when you think of what we could learn about what God was saying is this is healthy for you to consume, when almost none of it had any validity to us in terms of the actual beastie that he was talking about. But all of it was extraordinarily instructive in terms of our coming to know and understand who Yahweh is and what he is offering. This next statement from Dode, I think, plays right into that. And it reads, "From all of my instruction and training, I have gained insight and understanding, because your eternal testimony serves as my source, providing the information I need to think properly and respond appropriately." Now, if I were to summarize the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, that would be my summation. I see it as Dode sees it, which is that it exists entirely for our instruction, for direction, so that we can gain insights and understanding. And that God's not providing insights and understanding on how to turn guns into butter. It's on how to get the most out of our life here on earth and how to maximize our opportunity throughout eternity and our relationship with him. So the instruction, the information, the understanding, the knowledge from his eternal testimony is that is specific to two things: us thinking properly and us responding appropriately to him. So he has summarized here what we gleaned, and I think throughout our whole program yesterday. You guys have any thoughts on that?
We're not. I think you're straining gnats.
taking the word too seriously. No, I know you're not.
You're obviously, yeah. That's what you're doing here. You're straining gnats.
You're too close to the debate.
Yeah.
In fact, let's strain a
couple
of that.
I'm hopeless over here.
Yeah, the first verb here is lamad. Lamad speaks of an education. Lamad would be the Hebrew word for, you know, in Greek we transliterate the Greek to get disciple, because all the religious terms in Christianity are based upon the Greek text, as if God spoke Greek, which he didn't. Well, lamad is the actual Hebrew word for disciple. And what disciple means is one who learns. So Dode is presenting himself not as a teacher here, but as a learner. So he's sharing with us what he's learned. He's talking about the value of being a learner, which means that when we read his writing, we're not viewing him as a teacher. We're viewing him as like us, as someone who is learning from what God has to say. The next word that I think is significant here is sakal. Sakal means to gain insight, to acquire understanding. And we've talked about this in the past. There is a huge difference between knowing and understanding. In English, we have a tendency to consider knowing and understanding similar, as if they were similar concepts. And I don't think they are similar concepts. Yada, which means to know in Hebrew, is to relationally be aware of, to acknowledge. Where bien, which is typically the most common Hebrew word for understanding, is defined as making connections. So that, I was having a conversation with Yoel earlier today that one of the great benefits in education, if you approach it correctly, particularly in things that are statistical in nature, is that if you can make connections, then you can think logically. You can exercise good judgment. You can make this giant leap from knowing lots of things to understanding. And I'd say that's really the difference between most college professors. They know a lot of things about their specific genre, but they don't understand any of it. And
you know why I left college? You know why? Well, I was just about, I don't know, 12 credits shy of an associate's degree, and I was about 23 years old, and I was making around $85,000 at the time, which was better than double what my economics instructor was learning. And I said, what the hell am I doing listening to these people? And I left. They were stupid. Every one of them. Every one of them I had nothing to share that was worth anything.
Yeah,
that's
why
I left.
I got frustrated. I went to law school the first day, and I looked around the room and said, you know, there's nothing here for me. The last 4 years of college, I don't think I've learned anything. I mean, it's true I didn't go to class, but I read the textbooks. I took the test, and I got all A's, but I'm not certain that I really learned anything. I mean, everything that I used later on in business, I learned in the fraternity house. I know how to get along with
people. My economics instructor wasn't even making a living, you know, a good one. I mean, so I left. I mean, it was just so, why am I listening to this dribble? Matter of fact, I'm one of the few people that probably ever passed a class and threw the teacher over his desk.
That's probably not a good
idea. But I did.
I wouldn't recommend that for the young people. For the young people listening to this program, we would advise you against following this behavior.
I would advise a teacher not to come up and poke his finger in my chest and call me an idiot fundamentalist boob.
Yeah, well, that's
especially
probably
when all the guy had to do, he wanted to talk about Labis Gemmikoses and the naked statues of men in Greece, and how Sophocles liked to drink ouzo and like young men, and he enjoyed Sophocles, and I was an idiot fundamentalist boob. And I said, I may be anything you want me to be, but
yeah,
if you touch me one more time, I will throw you over your desk. And I said, you can believe that. And he did it. And I did it.
Yeah, let me
take
a little different approach to the Greek idiocy. We are indoctrinated in education to believe that Plato was one of the great thinkers of all time, that Socrates, like Plato, was a brilliant philosopher, that Aristotle was the most acclaimed student, and Aristotle was the brilliant teacher who somehow volunteered to bequeath his knowledge to Alexander the Great, which enabled him to become a great general. It's all poppycock. Plato was absolutely
sophists.
Right. Plato wasn't right about anything that he said. Plato was the fellow that while he is not credited with Gnosticism, is the individual who popularized Gnosticism. So his whole view was that the physical world was corrupt, it was imperfect, but that there was an imaginary world, a real universe, but unknown, that was perfect, and that the material world was simply a reflection and a degradation of the of this other world out there. And he, along with Socrates and Aristotle, taught that the entire universe was comprised of the four elements. And if you think, well, elements, he must have known about atoms. No, the elements were, you know, fire, water,
earth, wind,
air,
water,
and
fire.
Yes. He was wrong about everything. He was immoral. He was arrogant. And he was flat out wrong. A huge percentage of St. Augustine's City of God is to equate Roman Catholicism with the Plato. And if you read Paul's letters, Paul was a Gnostic. The reason Christianity, his version of Christianity, prevailed is he promoted Gnostic myths. That's why Paul says the flesh is evil, the spirit is good, and he has all of the evils listed of the flesh and all of the virtues of the spirit. That's all pure Gnosticism. And he used Gnosticism to equate the Torah and circumcision and the covenant with the flesh, and faith in his gospel of grace with the Spirit. It's pure Gnosticism. It's based upon the drivel that your professor was sharing. Now, that did for his day, did Plato know a lot? Yeah. Did your professor, talking about the naked statues and the amoral behavior of his beloved philosopher, know a lot? Absolutely. Did he understand what time of day it was? No, not a clue. And
you know, it's funny, you were talking about, you were talking about the ability to make connections being what allows us to think rationally and logically. You know, in debate, there's a logical fallacy known as non sequitur, which literally
Correct.
Means does not follow.
It, Correct.
You know, it's when you make a statement that doesn't connect with the last statement, it's kind of changing the subject. And it happens to be one of the favorite debate fallacies of religious people.
I would say it is the favorite. Because in every debate
it's
I've ever
with
had
straw
with a
man.
Religious... Yeah, with every... Well, straw man is and so is ad hominem. And
yeah.
Those are the three. Ad hominem means that rather than attacking what you have to say, they attack you personally.
They attack the messenger, yeah.
Right. That's ad hominem.
That's got to be the favorite, I believe.
Right. Now, there are places where ad hominem is the appropriate debate tactic. For example, if you're going to talk about Islam, it has to be an ad hominem attack because you have to base it on Muhammad. If you want to talk about Christianity, it has to be an ad hominem attack because you've got to base your criticisms of Christianity on Paul. So there are places where ad hominem means something. But the problem with a Christian, and this goes right back to what Paul is saying here, and the difference between knowing and understanding and the value of understanding and looking at Yahweh's testimony as his eternal witness for the express purpose of enabling us to understand him and respond to him appropriately, is that once you use Yah's testimony, which is irrefutable, once you use evidence and reason to prove that a Christian position, for example, Jesus, Christ, Christmas, Easter, cross, Trinity, Holy, New Testament, once you use logic and reason and Yah's testimony to disprove any one of those arguments that a Christian will raise, there is not a Christian on the planet that will come back and acknowledge, okay, you've used Yah's testimony and you have proved that my argument is erroneous. I therefore will acknowledge that it's appropriate for me to listen to what Yahweh has to say and acknowledge that my religion was wrong on this point and may be wrong on others. I have never heard that. 100% of the time, what they do is they realize they can't defend the use of Lord, for example. They can't defend New Testament when you read Yirmiyah 31. So what they do is they just change the subject. Move on to the next point.
You know, in this debate that I was just having, this fellow just told me that acting like a scholar is nonsense. You're a Pharisee. Now, I was posting Yahweh's words, extant words, and he just told me.
That happens a lot, too. Now, what's interesting here, and we had a discussion last week, that there really is nothing that you can say to us when we are trying to convey what Yahweh had to say. If you accuse us of being religious and accuse us of being Pharisaic in particular, that is the single greatest insult that you can provide. That shows that you are incapable of thinking the process through, and you're specifically trying to be insulting. Now,
And what he just said to me was that we're to be childlike.
Yeah.
And I said, well, childlike in that we're to trust, as a child does, their parent, we're to trust Yahweh in that regard.
Yeah.
I said lack of knowledge and being childish is another issue.
Yeah.
And then I posted Hosea, you know, where he said,
yeah.
you know, my
lack of knowledge.
Children
yeah,
are damned from lack
right.
of knowledge.
Yeah.
yeah.
And if
there
you look at Dode, and I know that last week either you or I were accused, Larry, of creating a religion of Dode, of David. Now,
I was accused of being your sidekick.
Okay. I appreciate you being my sidekick because if you're going to be in a treadmill, you'd like to have somebody at your side that can kick. Okay. That being the case, I want to dare go back into what got us in trouble.
Okay.
Dode is way beyond God's favorite person. Yes, Dode is God's favorite person who has ever lived. He's way beyond that. There are references in virtually every book to David. There are probably 10 to 20 times more references to Dode than there are to the Messiah, to Yahusha, and the Torah prophets and Psalms. Yahweh has a man crush on Dode. I mean, that's all there is to it. And it's always the kingdom of Dode. It is the reign of Dode. It is the seat of Dode. It's the city of Dode. It's the covenant of Dode. Dode is the guy. I mean to tell you, when we are in the millennial Shabbat, Yah's not saying that I'm going to establish my kingdom. He says, I'm going to establish the kingdom of Dode. Okay.
Yes, he does say that.
So it's imperative. It's not imperative. Nothing's imperative. It is instructive for us to take a step back and say, all right, why did God go so far as to say that this man who, you know, doesn't exactly have exemplary behavior, that this man is so vital to the message God's trying to communicate, what he wants to achieve with us, that when he returns and experiences the millennial Shabbat with us for a 1,000-year reign here on earth, that he's going to model his kingdom after this fellow. Does it cause you to say, I better take a moment and think about what is it about this guy?
It didn't until we seriously started studying this, and now I get it.
I get it, too.
Yah was saying Dode gets it because he's not throwing a bunch of religion out there. He's looking at what's important.
Correct.
And
focus
he's,
on what's
it's
important.
A relational thing with me. Yeah, go
yep.
ahead. I'm sorry.
I was having a conversation today with Yoel's wife, and we're having lunch with the whole family there, and we were talking about how the thing that's so appealing to so many of us is the intelligent level that God communicates at, that what he has to say appeals to people who like to think, appeals to the mind. It appeals to science. It appeals to history. It appeals to rational thought. And we went on to say that, you know, when you look at his testimony, it just all fits together. All the pieces fit together like a puzzle. And
perfectly.
I said, yeah, but I want to take that metaphor one step further. God doesn't put the pieces together for us in the puzzle. He gives us all the puzzle pieces. He wants us to put them together to form
the
picture.
Yeah, you spend your lifetime putting those together. Absolutely.
Right, now let me talk about why that is. If God said, okay, Larry, you know, you didn't get your associate's degree, so I know you're not very smart. In fact, you're really not very smart at all. I made it, and Larry, I'm here to tell you, you're a stupid boob. So, Larry, because you're so stupid, I'm going to really dumb this down for you. I'm going to make it really simple for you, Larry. And what I'm going to do is these are the four things that you've got to profess. You say these four things, Larry, and I'll cut you a deal. I'll save you. But I know that if I tell you anything more, I'm pressing my luck with you because, you know, you're really not very smart. So we'll just keep it really simple and stupid for you. How about that, Larry? Is that going to be appealing to you?
How about that? Well, then that means that he would be around morons for all
right.
eternity. I
correct.
Get why this is the way it is.
So
sure.
what he said instead was, I'll tell you what, if you're serious about coming to know me, if you like learning, if you find a voyage of discovery fun, if you like who I am and what I have to say, then I'm going to lay all the pieces out. I'm going to color them. I'm going to shape them. I'm going to make them brilliant. But I'm going to give you those pieces And I'm going to encourage you to see how they fit together to form the picture so that when you put them together, you're going to have an aha moment and go from knowing to understanding. And the response to that from Yoel's wife is, yeah, that's the basis of relationship, isn't it? Now you're having a conversation.
Well, it's a continuing answering of the puzzles and fitting the pieces together that is the relationship.
You know, yes.
As we were discussing, I equated that it was maybe an oversimplified metaphor, but you have a long drive, and if the conversation is simple as do these four things, and then we're done, that's equivalent to having a road trip where you talk about the weather for the first couple minutes, and you're done.
Right.
It doesn't give you much of a relationship for the next 3 days of the trip.
Exactly.
It drives me crazy that people don't want to put forth the effort that they would into any other relationship, into their relationship with God. Really, why would you think that that would be what God wants?
Right. Exactly. And why would you want it? Why would you want to go spend eternity with somebody you don't
even
like?
Exactly.
You know, if you take that same road trip and you say, you know, we're going to go to the zoo. I think we're going to go to the zoo. And what do you think we're going to see at the zoo? And when we see mongooses, what do you think they're going to be like? What kind of enclosure are they going to make for them? Well, you know, when we check out the giraffes, you know, what do you think we're going to see? And you talk about that, and then after you've been there, you say, so, you know, how did these various things meet, exceed your expectations? What things were different? And now you're talking about stuff that's meaningful, that's interesting, rather than, do you think it'll be hot? Yeah, it's the whole process of learning. Larry, 2 weeks ago and 3 weeks ago, you asked that we focus the show on the idea of loneliness and how for most who are in their first month or so of getting to know Yahweh and participating in the covenant, that many, if not most, experience a bit of loneliness because their loved ones, husbands, wives, brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, children, are still clinging to some societal myth or religious myth or political myth or that sort of thing.
I suggest much more than a month. I think for quite a while, but okay.
Okay. But a lot of us start off that way. And
yep.
It's important for us to talk about because after a while, I mean, for example, I am never alone. I don't ever have even an inkling of being alone. And the reason is that I find that time studying Yahweh's word is my conversation. He's as real, as present, as fun to be around, as informative, as conversant as you could possibly want. And that is not only for me to say that's sufficient is to demean the experience. But that's what this is all about. Examining in depth the words, thinking about them, making connections, coming to understand. And once you come to understand, it's the most liberating experience in the universe. I mean, that's the empowerment of the whole thing. That's when you say, you know, oh, for example, we're going to start, I knew we were going to start on verse 119. Because I understand what Dode is trying to communicate, what he represents to us, who Yahweh is, you don't need to think, well, you know what I need to do now is let me meditate on this for the next hour so we're prepared to do it. No, you don't. It's going to literally flow out of you because you understand what's being presented. And, you know, that is the story of Dode, is that he is a guy that transitioned knowing to understanding because he was passionate for Yah's testimony. If there was dot to dot in his day, he'd have never figured out how to hold the appointment to throw the stone at Goliath. I mean, he would have been preoccupied. He would have never come out of the cave His whole love was making connections, learning. And, you know, I think so much of the universe, so much of the word, so much of life is about us making the connections. Like, what's unique about humankind? Well, we're an upright creature. We walk on our feet. We use our hands. As parents, we get down on our knees. We lift our children up. We raise our children in a home. We nurture them. We love them. We support them. We defend them. We're excited when they grow. When something happens that our children discover an ability, we're far more excited than if we had achieved that same thing. You don't think there's a connection with every single one of those things in Yahweh and the covenant? And when you make each of those connections, brings a smile to God's face. That's what makes him happy.
Well, I agree. I mean, you know, that's the whole thing here. It's learning. It's looking at his words. It's understanding them. It's following them. It's observing them.
Fun.
Yeah. And, you know, I would even go so far. You were engaged in, and I wouldn't, it's probably inappropriate to call it a debate. But you were engaged in a discussion where somebody was saying that, you know, you shouldn't care that God doesn't use the word holy, and that holy is a religious term, and that set apart is the right term, and set apart has an enormous amount of meaning, and very, very important to Yahweh, the concept of set apart. If in doing that, you were able to pull together a number of different statements that Yah had made about the importance of understanding and the consequence of not understanding his message, even though it did nothing for the individual you were confronting, it was still a good experience for you. Reinforce what you know. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, yeah. This guy is basically a messianic.
Yeah,
is what he is, or he's been studying with messianics. So he's got, two religions that he's involved in. He's just now figured out that Paul was a scumbag. Okay.
Oh, so that's gonna really screw up his relationship with his messianic pals.
Yeah. So he's in here using religious terms all over the place, and it's Ha Masiach Yahshua, and on and on and on.
And, yeah, and by frankly, the way, you should ask him. I want you to tell me where in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms there is Ha Masiach. Why don't you?
I did.
Why don't you point to me to where it's written? And of course, you'll say.
I did ask him.
Yeah, you'll say Daniel 9. I said, okay. Let's open up our interlinears because they'll at least present what the Masoretic has, because of that particular portion we don't have it extant in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Why don't you find the Ha for me before Masiach? And if it is then Masiach would have to be a noun, right? Why don't you look up the form of speech that Masiach is, and you tell me if you can find the Ha, the definite article. And I said, no, you can take all day. In fact, why don't you take a year and you get back to me on this? Because what you're going to find is that there is no Ha, and that Masiach is used twice as an adjective. Now, there is no such thing. There is no title in the universe that's ever been comprised of an adjective. Adjectives modify nouns. An adjective is like a red wagon. You know, it denotes the color of the wagon, fast wagon, nice wagon, big wagon, little wagon. It's an adjective that modifies the noun. And so the noun...
I'd like my new title to be red, not the
red. Okay, red, there you go, your new title. I want my new title to be nice. That'll be a conflict. That'll start a lot of people crazy. But I'm going to be called the nice because I like ha nice better. So you can call me the nice. That's funny.
Craig the nice.
Yeah, there we go. Craig the nice. Craig the nice. The fact of the matter is that Masiach is very seldom used, and it's an adjective when it is used, And it's, and in the case of Daniel 9, when it talks about the arrival of the one who is set apart to be an effective messenger, Mashiach is an adjective modifying messenger. So if you wanted to give him a title, it would be HaMalach, the messenger. But why give him a title when all he is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh? I was, for a long time, guys, I want to tell you, I was perplexed. I mean, I was really, this is going to sound stupid, probably for most of you, but I was really weirded out by why Christianity was named Christianity, why you were called a Christian, and why it was Jesus Christ, and why the big, profound thing was he's the Christ, and when there's only two references to Mashiach in association with Yahusha in the whole Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. There are other uses of the adjective Mashiach, but they have nothing to do with Yahusha. And so why would this be such a profound thing and a religion named after it, and the religious, the Jesus Christ, is that be his last name, when it's a non-issue? I'm here to tell you there are 22 times when the name Mashiach is used, but there isn't a single place where it is HaMashiach. And so, it's always so peculiar to me. I never could understand why it was such a big deal in the Christian New Testament, and it's not only not a deal in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, it's non-existent. Now, I'm very comfortable with the answer now, but it took me a long time to reconcile myself to it. What do you guys think? Want to take a stab at it?
I would think that it would be to get rid of Yah. That's what I would think.
No. Okay, so what you're trying to do is you're trying to say why the Christians did it. The Christians did it to because you had this Greek term. The Greek term means drug. It's perfect. It has absolutely no association with Yahweh. So let's just name him the Christ. And that gets us completely away from Yah. I think you're probably right. There's a lot of truth to that.
I think the big thing is that he's trying not to emphasize the fact that this is something that distinct is from himself.
That's the answer. That's the answer. And that's also the answer to the question of why is it that we don't have a copy of Matanyah and Yaokanan in Hebrew? Why don't we have a reliable copy of any book in the witness writings? Why is there nothing reliable? Why is there nothing in the original language?
Because we weren't to focus on that to begin
with.
That
is correct. That is correct. I think that's what you were inferring there, Yoel, is that Yosha is really irrelevant. The Mashiach is really irrelevant. It's just Yahweh. And if you know nothing but Yahweh, and that Yahweh diminished an aspect of his nature as the set-apart spirit to form the role of our spiritual mother and enlighten us and perfect us, and that he himself set apart and diminished an aspect of his nature to honor his personal promises, and that he took this diminished manifestation of himself to be the living witness of the word, that's all you need to know. I came to the conclusion, and this is what I think you were saying, Yoel, is that the entire emphasis of Christianity, even if they had the testimony correct, even if they had the terminology correct, the entire fixation on Yahusha is entirely wrong. If you never knew his name, you never knew his title.
Right.
If you knew nothing about him, I mean absolutely nothing, you don't miss anything. that's important. Is that what you're saying, Joe? Or Yoel?
Well, and that was that's something, for better or for worse, I just took as, you know, for granted as the quote-unquote New Testament not being anything new for the last decade or more, is because it's really more of, I call it the examples versus the instructions, where the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, the metaphor that is, if, you know, if you're reading, you know, a large book on some technical thing, if you want the shortcut and just don't want to read the whole thing and really understand it, you go right to the instructions. But the real meat and how to be good and how to be conversant is always in, you know, the main instructions and the full reference manual. So
yes.
I've always taken from, you know, day one that, you know, I'll just really focus on the Torah, prophets, and Psalms with the research you were doing, Craig, and it's always served me well, and I think this is just another example of that. It's God doing the same thing.
Yeah. You know, in fact, I would go to all the way to the extreme, UL, of saying there is no New Testament.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm obviously trying to cut through that conversation by using
but there is no New Testament. That's just
right.
The bottom line. So why would he want to give us a accurate terminology and an accurate text of a text that, from his perspective, doesn't exist? It's not only not appropriate or credible, from his point of view, it's meaningless. Now, you might say, okay, you're pushing it a little too far there, because you know, you cite Yosha's testimony and you speak of Yosha fulfilling these events, yes. But if I can cite Yosha's testimony by citing the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, I mean, there is nothing that he said that isn't in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
Yeah, the entity is just a manifestation of his words. It's an example.
Yes.
So,
and literally a manifestation.
It doesn't need to be, yeah, it's, in many ways, that's a whole conversation you could get into, the deepness of that one statement there, the word manifest and all that other fun stuff
right.
We've talked about before. But, yeah, I mean, it doesn't need to be emphasized as anything special, because it's just literally the example of what he's been telling us all along.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, rather than emphasize, the whole concept of going from energy to matter is about a de-emphasis. So why would you want to de-emphasize Yahweh by focusing on the corporeal manifestation that, according to E equals MC squared, must be radically, massively de-emphasized? I know that there are a lot of folks listening here that are recently out of Christianity. And to go so far as to say that Yahusha is irrelevant is difficult. Larry, you just left a discussion with a Messianic Jew that wants to talk about HaMashiach Yeshua, or whatever he wants to call it. And the real answer is, he's irrelevant. He's so close to being irrelevant, you might as well start with the irrelevant point of view. He really is irrelevant. What's relevant is Yahusha. He is Yahweh's mouth. He quotes Yahweh. He is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh. Focus on Yahweh. Don't worry about
Well, I don't think that Messianic Jews understand who Yahusha is. They think he's some rabbi or something like that. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. And by the actual term rabbi, he would qualify. Which means,
well,
exalted.
Yeah, sure he would.
Yeah, even though he is
but
the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, that's still pretty
said
exalted.
It's Yahweh.
Yeah. Now, you know what's interesting here, and I want to go right back to Dodd.
Mm-hmm.
When you're reading the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, how many times do you read the kingdom of Yahusha? I am going to establish my kingdom on the Maaseyah. The Maaseyah Yahusha, he is one righteous dude. How often do you read that?
Well, you don't really read it, and I think it's back to
yeah.
what
the
Yoel
answer,
just.
The
I don't think
never,
Yoel
absolutely never.
Right. Yeah, but I think that's because Yahweh doesn't like to talk about himself, but he is pointing us in a direction, for sure.
Right.
You know.
But he's constantly telling us how righteous Dode is.
Yeah.
Constantly.
That's right.
Right?
Yes.
So what God's pretty humble. He doesn't really toot his own horn. And so he's not going to say, hey, Yosha's really a righteous dude because Yosha is him. And it's just not in Yahweh's nature to boast. He'd have every reason to boast, but he just never does. And occasionally he'll rub it in his wayward children's face when they're off chasing and worshiping idols they've made with their hands, and said, you're going to trade the Almighty Creator of the universe for something you created with your own hands? Are you crazy? I mean, that's about as far as he goes in terms of boasting. So he's not going to be touting Yahusha, because from his perspective, Yahusha is not something to tout. It's a diminishment of himself. No. What's to tout is, I created a human, this fellow Dode, who not only had an affinity for putting the pieces together, but when the pieces were together, he saw the big picture. And he didn't just see the big picture and understand the big picture. He was so passionate about the picture he saw that he immediately went to song to sing about it, to share what he was discovering so that others could benefit from what he was learning. And that kind of cooperative, relationship-based learning and sharing is why it's the kingdom of Dode. It's why this is the guy that Yahweh fell in love with. And so, well, I hate the term religion. If we're going to be accused of taking an extreme position, taking Dode's position is the single best position we can take. We're never told to that there's going to be a kingdom of Moshe, are we?
Nope.
There's a covenant with Abraham, yeah. But Abraham means a merciful father, but we're never told that Moshe is going to come back as the basis of a kingdom. You know, what's kind of interesting, too, is that from what we can tell, once Moshe came to know Yahweh, he only did one thing wrong. He struck a stone rather than talking to it. Right? He struck a stone rather than talk to it. That's the only thing that he did wrong in. And Yahweh really had a conniption fit. He says, no. I didn't tell you to strike the stone. I told you to speak to the stone, and for that you're not going to the
Why do you think
life.
That is?
Pardon?
Why do you think? I'll tell you why I think it is.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. And I think
the rock got struck instead of spoken to. That's what I think.
Yeah.
I think that's why it was a very big deal.
Yeah, I think that's probably 90% of it. I think there's another 10%.
Okay, so you think that too.
By the way, who is the rock? Who is the cistern of the rock?
That would be Yahusha.
The cistern of life.
Yeah.
It's Yahweh, right? Right, it's
Yahweh.
Right, does God want you to talk to him or hit him? There was a really important metaphor being communicated here in the difference between talking to and striking. What do you think the other reason was?
Oh, he's serving an example.
I do not know.
Trust.
Yeah.
The example
something
just to listen to follow instructions. You mean
you imagine being there, and you're out there in the desert. Your people are dying of thirst. There isn't a blade of grass within 100 miles of where you're standing. They're in a stream. They're in an oasis. And you're sitting here with hundreds of thousands of people. They just crossed a Salton Sea. And here they are, and they're thirsty, and God told you to go talk to a rock. Wouldn't you think maybe if I could put a little more emphasis into it, I really hit this rock, there's a bigger chance that I won't be making it. What if I just go up and talk to the rock and say, okay, rock, bring forth water, and am I going to look pretty stupid? You know, I can see his vulnerability, but no, I think Yahweh had spent all of the time with Moshe, from the time that he found him in Arabia to the time that he encouraged him to go with him to Egypt, to all the miracles, all the stuff in Egypt, to leading him across the Sinai Peninsula and into Arabia, And he was revealed his Torah, and here's Moshe. Now, okay, Moshe, talk to the rock. This is the guy that Yahweh laid down his foundation. And if the guy that God lays down his foundation is going to interpret Yah and take it into his own hands to take a his approach rather than God's approach, that's not cool. And can you imagine God choosing you to describe his foundational doctrine, his basis for everything in the universe, and then he asks you to do something, you say, yeah, I'm going to do it my way. Forget about all that stuff that you just told me. That was serious.
Yeah, it's an attempt to nip Jewish Yom Kippurim and stuff like that in the bud.
Yeah.
Say, you can't afflict yourselves. What part
right.
of this is a gift? Please accept it. Just accept it.
Right.
That's
yeah, talk to me, and I'm going to give you the gift of water. Don't afflict yourself. Don't strike me.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't think affliction, well, you don't, as an example, think affliction's a good way to reconcile a relationship?
Well, not when the whole concept of obviously the gift is in the Sabbath is obviously not to, that you can't earn your way. I think it's the tip of the iceberg, the Moshe striking of the rock was the, let's try to serve as an example of how important it is to get this one right. This isn't one of many thousands of lessons, and I think the extremity of it serves to try to, you know, put an accent point on that.
Well, I was just kidding.
Yeah, I think it was the UL that actually, I know you're being facetious, Larry, but
yeah.
UL, when we were talking about how, and this goes back to a conversation we had a lot of years ago up there in my carriage house as we began this discussion. There's an interest, adah is the Hebrew word for this translated afflict. And adah does mean afflict. It happens to be about the 18th definition of adah. The primary definition of adah is answer. The secondary definition is respond. And Yom Kippurim is an invitation to meet with God. The natural way that you would respond to an invitation is to answer it. And so it is obvious that Yahweh is using Anah to mean, I want you to answer this invitation. I want you to respond to this party that I'm throwing. What fun is the party if you don't respond? And so while it is obvious that just as he told Moshe to, you know, ask me, and I'll have the rock gush out with water. Don't strike it. God's saying, I want you just to answer the invitation. Answer me. Respond. I mean, please, answer me. Respond. That's all I'm asking for here. But what we talked about that day years ago was there is a benefit, however, to having Anah have two different connotations so that there still is embedded in Anah the concept of afflict. Because while we're just asked to respond and answer the invitation, Yahweh did afflict his soul on Pesach, on Matzah, so that we could enjoy Kippurim. So there's so many Hebrew words that have double meanings, and you have to to translate the word based on the context. But in this particular context, I think both applications were meant depending on. On who was performing what role at the party.
Just like Teruah.
Yes.
It's a warning or it's a celebration. It depends on your perspective.
Celebrate this news. I'm inviting you to the most extraordinary party in all of the universe. I'm also telling you this is a warning. You can listen to it any way you want.
Well, it's also an example of that would be that in all religion, there's worship, and
right.
part of that is bowing down as
right.
though, you know, Yahweh has an inferiority complex similar to that of Hitler or Stalin or somebody, and he's afraid to lose power, so people have to be submissive in front of him.
And God must think
so
that
it's really very insulting.
Down, that he wants to see our behind, that he thinks our behind is more interesting than our faces. I mean, what else,
yeah, well,
what else
I mean,
do you
it's
want
very
to
insulting out? Because if anybody bowed down to help somebody, it was him bowing down to help us. I mean,
so he's the one that got
pathetic.
On his knees. Yeah, Barak, a wonderful term. That God got
everything
down on his
has
knees.
To be backwards.
Right, to lift us up. One of the most important Hebrew words, it's easily in the top ten, is kara. It means to call out, to invite, to summon. Now think of the
you
difference.
One of the books of the Torah after it.
Absolutely. The third book of the Torah is kara, invitation. There is a profound difference between a summons and an invitation. If I get an invitation in the mail, you're throwing a party, and it's going to be good food, good drink, good fun. You know, I'm going to smile and say, yeah, count me in. Just tell me when and where, and I'll be there. If instead I'm getting a summons, now, I'm not going to respond to that favorably. I mean, that summons, I'm being summoned before a judge to court. There is nothing good that's coming here. Now,
makes me think of getting a jury summons.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to tell you, kara is absolutely legitimate, translated summons, just as an invitation. And depending on your response to the invitation, it will become a summons to you. You're going to be summoned before the judge if you don't answer the invitation.
What if you get, as an example, Yada, what if you get summoned down to City Hall to face the water police? What then?
I'm going to conceive
you
a way
call
to, become,
out.
To become independent of them because of the fact, which I am now, I have my my whole independent solution. I'm going to do so because I don't like to be controlled. I don't like authority. I don't like my freedoms constrained. And so I am naturally rebellious against authority and laws and constraints. And so I'm going to tell you, that this, by the way, ties into what we're talking about here. The beauty of Dode's approach to the Torah, and since Dode was inspired, and we know in fact he was inspired because of what Yahweh has to say about him and the fact that his lyrics are filled with the most profound prophecies in the entirety of the Torah prophets and Psalms. There is no question that his testimony was inspired by God. Dode takes the approach of there's no rules to obey in the Torah. There's no laws for you to keep in the Torah. There's instruction for you to understand in the Torah. I view instruction as enlightening, and the more I know and understand, the more liberated I am. Laws constrain, education and knowledge liberates. My nature is such that if God were telling us, this is, I am your Lord, these are my laws, you obey them, I would be much better off having my soul just evaporated at the end of my existence than I would be making myself and him miserable for eternity.
And that is why the religious copy editors worked so hard to present the false nature that they do
right.
in religious material. That's my opinion. I think
I agree.
Completely
I agree.
Purposeful. It's hateful. I think it creates atheists. It
yep.
creates hate. It certainly
yep.
creates confusion. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that, you and I talked a lot early on in this process, and once it went off in your head, once you understood Yahweh's Father, covenant is family, Torah is instruction, once you got the basis, there was nothing I could tell you that I learned in studying that was a surprise. You'd say, of course it had to be that way. And ever since you've come to embrace the Torah, the covenant, and Yahweh, you have never been uptight about anything. It's just every process of it is liberating and comfortable, which is the same position I find myself in now, just totally relaxed.
The only part I have any issue with is the necessity of circumcision. It's like the one thing, the thorn in my cross, so to speak.
Yeah, and it is, and you know that it is absolutely unambiguous circumcision of the flesh and of the spirit are no Passover. And the expert on circumcision in our group is actually JB, who has studied it in every possible way. I don't want to get in depth on this, but I want to give it. I want to talk about it a little bit from a 30,000 foot overview, the view out of the airplane window, if I may. There are five absolute requirements for participating in the covenant. You don't have to do any one of the five things. You don't have to know anything about them. You don't have to accept them. You don't have to engage based upon them. You don't have to agree with them. You're free to do, you're even free to corrupt them and distort them and to lie about them. You can do whatever you want to. Five terms and conditions of the covenant. If there's any one of the five you're unwilling to do, you're not welcome in God's family. And they are absolutely designed for a specific reason, and that is we're going to spend eternity together. We're going to be really close. And I have a hunch that in heaven, sarcasm and humor is going to play a big role. God doesn't want to be around a bunch of people that get their behind all in a twit. He doesn't want to be around people that are going to drag religious and political lies into his environment. He hates that stuff. And so there's five absolute requirements. And if you don't want to go along with these, you're cool except you can't come into heaven. You're just not invited into his home, can't live in the forever. And the first of those is, just like circumcision is an absolute requirement, you have to disassociate yourself from religion and politics, from Babylon. Now, I understand that. Why would God want the adversary's lies to endure forever with him in his home? I get it. The second is you've got to trust and rely on Yahweh. Well, I want to tell you, it's not that easy, because you can't trust somebody you don't know, and you can't rely on something you don't understand, and therefore you are required, absolutely required, to think about this, to devote some time to it, to understand it, or you're not welcome. And it should be that way, because if you don't like Yahweh, if you're not excited about learning about who he is, you'd be miserable in heaven. You'd make all of us miserable. And the third is you walk to him and become perfect, which means you need to answer the seven invitations. And if you don't care enough about God to meet with him when he's throwing this party for our benefit, you're just not welcome in his family. And he's serious about these terms and conditions. I mean, that's the fourth one. He says, you need to observe them. If you're not willing to observe them, which means to closely examine and carefully consider them, because he said, these are absolute terms and conditions. These are the requirements for participating in my covenant. If they don't mean enough to you to closely examine and carefully consider them, then my family is not a priority to you, and I don't want you in my home forever. And then the one on circumcision, Joe, is really interesting. While it says that a man can't attend Passover unless he's circumcised, where it says a man can't enter heaven unless he's circumcised, the instruction actually reads that parents, we're asked to circumcise our sons on the eighth day. And what God is saying there is, I want people in my home that get it, that are raising their children to be my children, to be the most, that they're committed to remembering who I am in their lives and who they are as part of my family. I want people as part of my family who view their family the same way I view them, who love their children the same way I love my children. And that's what circumcision is. It's our commitment to raise our children to be Yahweh's children. Now, the reason, Yoel, that Yahweh has an absolute requirement that you, as a man, you be circumcised to attend Passover. Do you know why that is? There's a reason for it. That why Yahweh says, if you're not circumcised, I don't want you to avail yourself of Passover. And it's the only one, by the way, he says, I don't want you to avail yourself of. You know why that is?
I mean, I never disagree with any of the motivations. It's just always been to me the one that's one thing to me is much more ceremonial and kind of rote compared to everything else. And so that's
And by the way, speaking of that, I'm gonna answer the question that I asked you. But does Yahweh ever explain how much to cut off?
This is true.
Does Yahweh ever tell you who has to cut it off? Does Yahweh ever say, when you're cutting it off, I want you to eat this food, I want you to be in this position, and I want you to say these things? There is no ceremony. So
no.
It is really interesting that God doesn't tell us diddly squat about it. He doesn't tell us how much to cut off. He doesn't tell us what we should do to we'll be cutting it off. There is zero ceremony about it. Now, okay, why does God not want us to, doesn't want any man to participate in Passover that isn't circumcised? What happens if you attend Passover and you're not part of the covenant? If you really capitalize
on Passover. You become eternal, but you'd be separated eternally.
That is correct. So God recognizes that an uncircumcised man, someone who has not accepted the sign of the covenant, who attends Passover, would become immortal but eternally separated from him. And that's the worst possible thing for them, which is why he doesn't want it done. Now, when Yahweh, through the prophet Ezekiel, told Israelites, amongst the greatest deceptions, the greatest distortions, the greatest corruptions that you have ever promoted is this notion that uncircumcised males are welcome in my home. Why do you think he said that?
You're asking me, or?
Yeah, I'm asking. I've got Yoel here, I've got James here, I've got Larry here.
Sounds exactly like you just said, to be able to benefit from matzah without benefiting from Passover is really the worst possible situation you could have.
Well, that's why you can't attend Passover. There's something else about this, even more, vastly more important. We're talking about probably, I'd say, 7 to 10 billion souls.
Yeah, he's separating 7 to 10 billion souls from the covenant. Period.
He's talking about what was the basis of the religion of Christianity, the creator of Christianity. What was the fulcrum? Circumcision. Why was Paul called to the Jerusalem summons? Circumcision. What was the basis of Paul's animosity against God? Earth. Circumcision. What is the basis of Paul calling the Torah and its covenant of the flesh? Circumcision. What was the basis of Christianity being a religion of faith? Circumcision. And so you've got the world's largest religion promoted by a Jew that says that circumcision is counterproductive, that if you are circumcised, that you have rendered Yosha's sacrifice moot. And so you've got almost 10 billion people who have been told that they're going to go to heaven who are not circumcised, and God calls that the greatest crime that Jews have ever committed. And why? Because circumcision is the sign of the covenants. It says... Yeah, I agree to all this. And you might say, okay, all these other things are mental. It's a mental choice, right? It's attitudinal, it's mental. Walking away from your country and from politics and militarism, attitudinal. Trusting and relying on Yahweh, that's both heart and mind. Walking to God and becoming perfect, that's relational. And observing the terms and conditions of the covenant, that's mental. Circumcision is physical. What part of a male anatomy is responsible for procreating children?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, in the perspective that you're touching upon here, and we know, I know where you're going with this, of course, is that you touched upon, I guess, my point, and I don't disagree with any of the merits of circumcision, but it's one of those things I always anticipate when I'm talking to the big guy that we're going to have a couple of thumb fights and some wrestling matches over.
Okay. You're going to have a thumb fight. Let me ask you a question, you will.
But
I'm going to get you prepared for this. So you get your, you know, your debate ready for it. When Yahweh says that he's establishing the covenant, do you know what verb he uses to say that he's establishing the covenant?
I do not know.
It's karat. Do any of our listeners here know what karat means?
Yeah, it means to cut.
It means to cut. Yeah, it means to cut. That's all karat means, is to cut. So he's cut the covenant. This word that we just read that was talking about that God has inscribed instruction to us that cuts us into the relationship choke. The idea of being set apart, there's a dividing line that's cut. You're on one side or the other. You're cut into the covenant. You're cut out of the family. Cutting, dividing, separating is really the essence of this life. As Joseph said, I didn't come to bring peace, I came to bring division. Yahweh wanted his people to be separated, cut away from the riffraff of the world. Everything to him is about cutting and dividing, separating. And so circumcision is a cut in a place that tends to get a man's attention. Hey, Yoel, I'm going to go off and do a lot of stuff with you. You know, we're up with the big guy, and we have a chance to go explore the universe and quiz him about the platypus. And I'm going to be right there with you when you talk to him about the platypus design.
I'm good. I think that's actually one of the only things you could say is undoubtedly flawless is the platypus.
The platypus design, yeah. I think there's a lot of us that are going to be in for the class on the platypus design. Okay, let's fess up now. What were you thinking when you created the platypus? Was it late at night? Did you have a seizure moment? Or were you doing it just to screw with our minds? Did you do this just because you could?
Well, they're probably born circumcised, too, which is the perfect
creature. Probably is. Yeah. Now, I want to go one step further on circumcision for you. The most, and it's going to come full circle again, the most influential philosophy probably in all of human history was that was articulated by Plato that became the basis of Pauline Christianity. That is Gnosticism. This idea of the person who is a Gnostic, based on the Greek word knowing, gnosis, that the most knowledgeable people in the world saw the world, the physical world, as impure, as unclean, as imperfect, and that there was this world of faith that you could believe in out there that was perfect. And it encouraged a disregard and a disrespect for the material universe. And it encouraged a faith-like longing for that which was unknown and required faith. And in the midst of this, you have the principal argument by the most popular religion by a huge margin in human history, based upon rejecting the covenant because it's of the flesh. Can you think of a better way to say, all right, let's make that the dividing line. That's what you think of me. Let's make that the dividing line. I think that the creation is good. When I created the earth, I said it was good. When I created life, I said it was good. When I created humankind, I said it was good. When I laid out my teaching, I said it was good. My people, my land, I think I did a pretty good job of creation, is what God's saying. You want to think it's corrupt? You want to think it's imperfect? You want to think you can do better? All right? That'll be the dividing line. We're going to have something of the flesh that I'm going to say that's good. That's an acknowledgement that you're with me. I think it's God's poking his finger right between Paul's eyes and saying, okay, big boy, you think you can throw me across the desk? Have at it.
You know what? I never thought of that. I never thought of it. But you're right. That's why he's doing it.
God's no nonsense, by the way. I mean, he knows the future. He knows that's going to be the biggest religion in human history. He knew the religion was going to be based upon that, and he says, all right, I'm uncompromising on this. I'm uncompromising on everything that's important to me, by the way, because that makes me dependable and reliable. But okay, you want this to be the dividing line? Have at it. See how it works out for you. I'm not changing. See if you can come up with you don't like my universe? You think my universe is imperfect? You think my word, my testimony, my plan is somehow corrupt? You think it's pornography? All right. You want to disregard what I have to say to an Old Testament? You want to come up with a new and different plan? All right. See how that works out for you. I'm not changing. Stuff it. You know, I see it. It's God just said, all right, have at it. I am absolutely convinced, based upon the Genesis account, that God not only is impressed with his creation. And I've done a lot of things in my life. I say, hey, that's really neat. That design is really, that's striking. I think it's beautiful. Man. And, you know, I've designed trinkets. You imagine designing the universe and say, whoa, I mean, that star, that planet, that tree, that life, that flower, that platypus. I think that's pretty amazing. And look at that human. And I think God not only is excited with what he's created, not only is he has a sense of pride that is appropriate for what he's created, but the single thing he wants to do is to share that with us. And he doesn't want somebody who's going to look at what he's created and say, yeah, I could have done better. That's flawed. There's a dead leaf on that tree. I could have done better. That's not you know, your designs are just a pale reflection of what I could conceive. And that's the basis of Gnosticism, which is the basis of Christianity. So that's the difference between man's views and God's views. God rather likes the world that he created. He thinks it's beautiful. I do too. And in eternity,
I pretty well come to view Christianity in the same light that Christians probably view, say, a movie they're watching about Troy, where they're talking about the gods and the gods on their side,
too.
And they find that laughable. Well, I kind of see them in the same boat there. I really
I do.
I mean, it's.
Yeah. Yep. I think for eternity, that a huge part of eternity is going to be God doing what he did with Adam and Chawa in the Garden of Eden, where he paraded the animals by and they had a grand old discussion about life. And if you don't like his universe, if you think you can do better, if you think that it's not all that impressive, it's not all that interesting, that it's flawed and imperfect, then why would God want you there?
I think it'll go well beyond that. There's a reason for that. Okay, let's say that you're empowered to the 10th power,
mm-hmm.
or even bigger than that, Yoel is. Imagine, okay? Now, Yahweh's going to be getting into things with you that you haven't even seen or thought or even considered.
Well, don't even have the capacity to to...
No, you don't. Yeah, that's what there's... I think you're going to go into places that are so far beyond the design of, you know, crocodiles and platypuses and so forth that it's going to be just an amazing feeding,
right.
You know.
Forever, because he's got to constantly create. Now, let me... There is so much more to where we're going. You know, when Yahweh was talking about it, one of the promises of the covenant is that we're enriched and empowered in Isharon, is the team that the term that he uses speaks of a magnitude of tenfold. And that's where you're getting the tenfold increase and enrichment and empowerment.
Well, I'm getting that, plus I'm getting the fact that he's an energy-based life form, and he's going to transfer us into being energy-based.
And that's not a tenfold. That's a squaring of the speed of light in terms of magnitude. I want to be a little careful here, because when I use the term infinity, I'm speaking with somebody that actually knows that what infinity means. But when you go from two dimensions... Mickey Mouse, for example, is a two-dimensional construct. You go from two dimensions to three dimensions, you have not increased by one-third. You've increased infinitely to go from two dimensions to three dimensions.
Yeah.
Well,
go from three dimensions to four dimensions.
You can't take a picture on a piece of paper.
Right, right. To be eternal in time and to be able to have the ability to... where time is something that you can navigate and you can use to your advantage, because you can, as energy-based, time simply is. To go from three dimensions to four dimensions is an infinite increase. And now you've got an infinite increase multiplied by an infinite increase. And we're not going from three to four dimensions. We're going from three to seven dimensions. And so you've got an infinite times an infinite, times an infinite, times an infinite from where we are now.
Right. And so the things that are going to amaze you then, I mean, you're going to go that way in terms of brain power, in terms of personal physical power, in terms of a lot of things. So,
right. And I want to say, I've always wondered why the universe is so big. You know, it is, the known universe is at least 30 billion light years across. Why is the universe so big? It's really going to take an enormously big universe to keep us entertained for an eternity, right?
I mean, yeah, but I think it's big enough to do.
Yeah. I mean, you could spend,
that is going to remake
you could
it
spend
anyway,
100
so.
Lifetimes exploring this Earth. There's so many wonderful things to see. And you could probably spend 1,000 lifetimes exploring our solar system. But we're talking about an eternal amount of time. You really need a big universe to keep us entertained and excited forever, with every new moment being something new and wonderful.
Yeah, and there's going to be places you like, I mean, that you really like, that you want to go back to and revisit, things like that. I mean, yeah, you're just talking about...
Well, I was reading in Yashaya yesterday. Yahweh was talking about eternity, and he's talking about, he says, I'm going to have for you the choicest pieces of meat and the absolute finest aged wines. Okay, so we're going to be having a feast with the best wine you could possibly taste in eternity. What that means is that for moments in eternity, we need to go right back into the ordinary flow of time and to become a physical, material being again, at which point, time starts to flow again. And we're going to be able to move in and out of, we find a place that said, you know, that is really neat. I'd like to spend a while here. And you can. I sat out in a lounge chair today and felt the sun on my skin. It's warm, and it was a cool breeze and a warm sun. I mean, that's a nice sensation. We're going to be able to do that. Drink good wine. I mean, there's my dog was rolling on the floor next to my desk, and she knocked down, scared herself to death. scared me half to death, too. But that combination of being eternal in time and still being able to go and be, when we want to just stop time and experience the ordinary flow of time and to take on a physical construct again, going to have, that's the best of all worlds, and we're going to have that opportunity. It's the Bukudim Yahusha. It is the Abraham meeting Yahusha, where they ate together, walked together, talked together, drank together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They even had a good argument, Yoel. I don't know if they thumb wrestled, but... and by the way,
that was the only one I could beat him in. That's why
yeah.
I brought it up.
Okay. Yeah. And by the way, Yoel, just to put a positive slash mark on your column, I am quite sure that I am absolutely positive when Yahweh told Abraham, "Oh, by the way, now we're going to have a little circumcision here as the sign of the covenant." That old Abraham said, "You know, you and I are going to have a little talk about this. You don't have to write it down for posterity, but you and I are going to have a little talk about this."
I don't know, if the whole Isaac thing, I think he was pretty much, trained at that point.
Yeah, you know what actually got, changed everything for, Abraham? Abraham was not the sharpest tool in the shed. No one is going to mistake Abraham for Dodd. That's why Dodd says, you know, when those who love the Torah, all of those who love the Torah are going to want to meet with me. And Dodd's right. If you love the Torah, you're going to want to meet with Dodd. If I have a moment or two, I might want to meet with Abraham. But do I have a hunger to meet with Abraham? No. Do I have a real desire? I mean, I've got a man crush on Dodd. Yeah, I'd love to meet with him, man. This is the smartest dude ever lived. So if you've got Abraham, who wasn't the smartest tool in the shed, who was constantly questioning everything Yahweh said, there was one moment in time that Abraham got it, and it wasn't the Isaac moment. Abraham was arguing with God, and he said, "Hey God, you know, you keep on promising me an inheritance. And come on, I don't get it. I don't have a kid. You've ruled out everyone that even works for me, all of my associates. You've said, no, not them. I don't have a kid, and you're talking about an inheritance. I'm 90 years old. I'm childless, and you keep on talking about an inheritance and all of these wonderful things that I'm going to have as an inheritance. What in the world are you talking about? Why are you yanking my chain? That does not equate." And so Yahweh took Abraham to heaven. He showed him the light of the stars and showing him light energy and saying, "This is what I'm offering you. You're going to become like light. You're going to become like me. You're going to have all the power and the eternity and the perfection and the enlightenment associated with the luminaries of the universe here in heaven. That is what I'm offering you." And Abraham came back and said, "Okay, I get it now. Okay, that'll work for me. Count me in." And from that point on, Abraham was, "Yeah, I'm right with you. Okay, you want me to do what? Okay, yeah, okay, that'll be fine." In fact, at that point, it was really only...
except for the Ishmael part.
Yeah, he did there for a while say, let's go with Ishmael. Yeah, you know, it's really nice.
And this is the guy that does all those stars, right?
Yeah. And what was really fun about the Ishmael part where Abraham is negotiating with Yahweh says, "You know, what about Ishmael?" And it's kind of like what's going to happen, by the way, Yoel, when you talked with Yah about circumcision and that you think that your presentation that you, circumcision really shouldn't be there because it's too ceremonial. You know what Yahweh's response to Abraham was when he was recommending, how about Ishmael?
No.
Absolutely, unequivocally, no. Not a chance. No way. He used the strongest. In fact, I don't even think that form of negation is found anywhere else in the Torah. It's just the one place. It's absolutely not. So, yeah, it's got, it's his family. He has decided that these conditions will make it fun for all of us for eternity. And, you know, so far it's working out pretty good. By the way, I was going to throw one other thing in there. When you mentioned the tenfold enrichment from the Isharon idea of enlightenment and enrichment, I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to say that our lives right now, as part of the covenant, are every bit tenfold enriched over what they were prior to our involvement in the covenant, and that the tenfold enrichment is just this stage of our relationship, and that the next stage is an infinite amount times an infinite amount times an infinite amount times an infinite amount. That's my perspective on it. Could be wrong, but it's certainly the way that I feel about it. It's my personal experience. All right, fellas, we have reached the 10 minutes past the bewitching hour, and I have a... I have three of Yoel's children that I am certain that are hungry, and I'm going to go take them to dinner.
My All right, you will have a good time.
I can help it.
I'm going to take Yoel so long as I don't have to thumb wrestle him. I'm going to take Mary. She's fun to talk with. Yoel's wife. All right, guys. Enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Okay.
Pleasure, Yoel.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Happy Shabbat.